It's been another busy week here at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks for taking time to catch up with our biggest headlines during today's Behind the Headlines podcast. I'm Katie O'Connell. Coming up in today's show, we'll take a look at the changes coming to the newly redesigned Milwaukee Art Museum. And our political team talks about the county board election and Chris Abley's head start in the race. Before we get to those segments, have you noticed something new on our website? We're partnering with the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. This news service brings the latest in hyperlocal journalism, focusing on Milwaukee's diverse and interesting neighborhoods. Reporter Brianne Chasso talked to Brendan O'Brien about his latest investigation for the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service. Brendan took a look into the cost of municipal citations on Milwaukee's poorest communities.
Brendan, a special report published in the last week explores the impact of monetary penalties in the city's municipal judicial system on the poor. What did you learn in the course of your reporting?
I learned that the system tries to strike a balance between justice for victims of crime, small crime, in the municipal court system, and what is fair to defendants in terms of a penalty. If you walk into the municipal court system with a citation, what should you pay? What is fair for your infraction? And what I learned is that a lot of people that walk in the municipal court system with a citation, a lot of people that get citations, don't have the means to pay. And so there's this imbalance. While judges try to strike some justice again for victims of crime, on the other end, the question remains, what is fair for defendants who can't pay? So one of the things I learned was there's alternative sanctions out there, like community service, that's available for defendants who know. And that's the key. Do defendants really know in the municipal court system that there's the alternative sanctions that if they can't pay, they can take advantage of? And part of the reporting found that many, if not the vast majority of them, have no idea that there is community service out there for them. The other major factor that I learned is that many don't have the correct legal representation. And when I say correct, I mean that if you have a lawyer, you're 7 or 8 times more likely to get your case dismissed or found not guilty. And so the questions remain on how, back to the main theme, is justice really being served in the municipal court system?
Is anything being done to make people aware of the alternatives to fines or how legal representation could help?
Municipal court administrators, judges, advocates out there are aware. The problem is how to operationalize getting the correct information to defendants. How do you inform a defendant who just got a citation that their best bet is to come to court? It says it on the citation in a somewhat veiled way. Most defendants sit there and say to themselves, it's just a bill, I've been found guilty if I get a citation, and that's it. So the administrators, court administrators, judges, advocates are trying to figure out how to better inform the public as to the processes and what to do with a municipal citation, how to fight it, what are people's rights.
How did you learn about this? How did you get into reporting this?
I started about 7-8 months ago looking at the municipal court system. One of the main reasons I started looking at the municipal court system in Milwaukee is what we've learned in other parts of the country, namely Ferguson. In many places around the country, the same questions, the same themes, the same narratives about municipal court have come up. And so I said to myself as a reporter, hey, what's going on in Milwaukee? Why is it any different? Is our municipal court doing some of these things better, worse, the same as what we found in Ferguson and Baltimore and other places? So that's how the idea kind of started as a reporter. And then I started going to court. I spent hours upon hours sitting in courtrooms in the municipal court facility. I spent hours in the facility itself, sitting in the waiting room, talking to defendants, talking to lawyers, talking to Judge Mosley, administrators. I stood outside the court building for hours looking for defendants that would talk to me. I jumped on the phone and started calling every source that imaginable around the city that would have anything to do with the municipal court system. And these are the things I found. And what I found is what's in the story, is there's a lot of challenges that municipal court faces, but administrators, judges, even police officials, city leaders seem to be cognizant of these issues. They seem to be aware of these types of situations that defendants are facing in terms of their economic plight.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
Yes. I want to say there, in all my reporting, I did not find anything nefarious in the judicial system. I think that's a really important element to this whole thing. That I didn't find anything questionable in terms of necessarily how individuals were doing their job. I found a system that has a lot of work to do. Another very important element to this story is that people should question their government. They should question when they get a citation. They should fight cases. They should go get police reports. Our justice system is a hallmark of democracy. If we are not questioning it, if we are not taking the time to be engaged citizens, engaged participants in the system, then we're failing ourselves. We're failing the system. We're failing the judicial system and every other defendant that comes along after us. So go out there. If you get a citation, go out there and fight it. Ask for the police reports. Ask to see the judge. Take the time to go to court. That's the key. If it's not going to help you out, it's certainly going to help individuals after you. If enough people go out there and do it, it will change the system.
To find content from the Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, you can visit our website, jsonline.com. You'll spot their headline list on there. And you can also go to their site for more. That's at milwaukeenns.org. Art critic and reporter Mary Louise Schumacher has exclusive insider access to the art world in Milwaukee. She got a tour of the new building and reconfigured spaces at the Art Museum. Once again, here's Brianne Chasseau and Mary Louise.
Mary Louise, this week you wrote two pieces about an advanced tour you had of the new building at the Milwaukee Art Museum, as well as some newly reconfigured spaces. Why did they build a new building?
Sure. Well, the Milwaukee Art Museum is about to open a brand new building, a small atrium, and also kind of unveil a completely reconsidered and rethought interior. So literally all of the art was taken out of the museum. They rethought everything and put all the art back. So it's really kind of a reinvention of the Milwaukee Art Museum. And what precipitated it was it's a big $34 million project, and one of the museum's primary buildings had been failing for many years. It had fallen into disrepair. It was leaking on the eastern face and some of its interior walls. And there was just this real need to get in there and fix everything. And so they used that as a reason to kind of rethink how they were presenting the art. And also, really, they had to kind of either restore the original building or create this additional little atrium, which is kind of extending or refacing that 1975 David Kaler building.
You make me so excited to go check it out. It sounds like you like it. Why? What do you like about it?
Well, the building is a relatively small building that had a lot of big jobs. It had to, you know, fit in on this cultural campus where you have other works of architecture that are significant and that very much assert themselves. So you've got the original 1957 Eero Saarinen building, this beautiful, kind of sober, cruciform building. You have then the 1975 David Kaler addition, which was sort of a plinth that went right out towards the lake from underneath the Saarinen. And then, of course, in 2001 came along the very, you know, attention-grabbing postmodern Santiago Calatrava. So that's a lot of kind of architectural noise. And this building had to enter into that conversation and actually find a way to be its own thing and not compete with those other things, which is really difficult to do. And then, you know, the building also had to kind of, it was eliminating that 1975 building, and it had to somehow figure out how to reface and eliminate aspects of that building while also honoring it. It had to create a lakefront entrance for the museum. In 2001, when the Calatrava opened, the museum was really cut off from the lake. So this building is also designed to create public spaces right on the lake so people can come into the museum and not only, you know, be close to the water and these other public spaces, but then get right into the art. So you walk in the new building now, and you don't have this long hall to get to the art. You just walk in, get your ticket, and you're literally right in the gallery. So, and it's a beautiful building. So in addition to that, it's just a very kind of industrious little building where you have this cantilevered upper floor that's faced in these steel panels kind of gently twisted over this very glassy first floor. And so you have these very kind of simple forms, but there's a really dynamic interplay in terms of the way that they play off of each other in various at various times of the day. Is there anything I don't like about the building? Yes, there is. There are some lovely public spaces inside. I love the first floor space. It's tiny, and I wonder how that's going to play out in terms of when it gets filled with a cafe and human activity. I hope it will retain its kind of wonderful character where you can step out of the galleries and kind of get your lovely dose of the lake and serotonin. But upstairs, there's a brand new exhibition space, which is a great thing. So the museum will have a whole new exhibition space for traveling or changing shows, much like the one in the Calatrava. So the fact that there's more than one means the museum can expand its programming, maybe take some more risks. But I have to say I'm a little concerned about the space. There are some kind of varying floating walls and some columns and the kinds of things that normally would interrupt one's art experience. So I'm going to reserve judgment because there wasn't any art in that space when I saw it. And so I'm very curious to see how that will work. But so far I'm not a fan.
When will the public be able to check out these new spaces?
Right. So the museum is hosting a grand reopening on November 24th, which is a Tuesday. The museum is closed on Mondays. But there is an opening for members. So if you're a museum member, you can get in next weekend. So that will be November 21st and 22nd.
Sadly, with the time constraints on this segment, we can't tell you what Mary Louise didn't like about the new spaces. But you can find that story in today's newspaper or online at tapmilwaukee.com. Chris Abele is getting a head start in the spring elections. He's already come out swinging, including airing commercials. Our JS on Politics team broke down Abele's early start during this week's show.
All right, well, let's shift now to one of our next topics, which is the spring elections and County Executive Chris Abele, who's out very early with TV ads and spending, and we'll talk about what that means. But first, we're going to show a bit of one of his first ads on kind of positioning himself as a reformer at the county level.
County Executive Scott Walker,
the county board
neglected county facilities.
Milwaukee County is going broke.
Plagued by mismanagement.
One civic group is even suggesting bankruptcy.
Chris Abele is cleaning up their mess. Balanced budgets without raising taxes 5 years in a row. Making Milwaukee a national leader in training fathers for jobs so they can support their kids. And he funds his own campaign so he can say no to the special interests. Chris Abele, someone working for us, for a change.
All right, so that's Chris Abele on the airwaves already. Dan, what's your take on this? Is he spending a lot because he has a lot, or is he in trouble, or what's going on?
You can read it in two different ways, but he's already got two ads out there, TV ads, and they're on a lot. And I got my third mailer yesterday from him, very, very slick, expensive stuff. And, you know, they haven't even started collecting signatures yet for the races. But the fact is, there is going to be a primary, even though there are two main candidates, Chris Larson and Chris Abele. There are other candidates. There will be an election in February for that. But you can read it in one of two ways. One, that he wants to get out front and resolve the election very quickly with a lot of his own personal money. Or two, that his numbers aren't very good. And some people have been saying he has been polling. I know of at least two polls he's done since the summer. So he knows exactly where he stands with the electorate, even if we don't.
Do you have a sense of that? I mean, do you think he's faring pretty well?
I've heard mixed signals. Some people have been saying that his favorability is not very strong, particularly among women. And you'll see in his ads that he has a number of women in there, and he's hitting this issue of child support a great deal. And the women make appearances both in the mailer and in his TV ads.
Yeah. Let me ask Patrick and Mary for their take on, you know, Chris Larson as a state senator who was in leadership for a time, no longer is, but can he... Is there enough support for him to match some of this? I mean, Chris Abele is quite wealthy and can fund his own campaign. Can Chris Larson raise enough to be competitive on the airwaves?
You know, Larson struggled as a leader. Obviously, he wasn't Senate Minority Leader that long. I don't know that Milwaukee voters necessarily care that much about that. And I think he's probably just trying to really exploit some of the weaknesses that Abele has with voters. And, you know, he can say that he's a strong progressive, a strong Democrat. I don't think that he has the personal wealth, obviously, that Abele has.
I think it's going to be two completely different types of campaigns. It'll be Chris Abele with his air war that he started now. And usually when you go up, you don't come down. So there are going to be a lot of ads between now and April. And I think that Chris Larson's going to try to emphasize ground troops. He's already lining up endorsements primarily from the unions. And that's what he's going to do, is they're going to be out and trying to go door to door and build support that way.
Yeah. Let me ask Patrick this. I mean, so sometimes in these cases, when you have someone running from one office for another, there's still... You can rely on support because, well, you're still in the other office, but Chris Larson's a minority in the minority party in the Senate. Does he have any real leverage to encourage people to contribute to his campaign, or is he, as Dan said, mostly going to have to go with a grassroots approach?
Well, I think it's clear that he's going to be underfunded compared to Abele. There's no way he can match that. Being in the state Senate is going to be helpful. He's going to be able to get endorsements from his colleagues to the extent that voters in Milwaukee will be interested in that. I think that he sort of represents the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Some of them feel like they've been left in the wilderness, particularly as it relates to Milwaukee County issues. The county board has really been neutered because of changes to state law that Abele was able to persuade Republicans to make. That's going to frustrate some people. So I think he's going to have this energy. He's going to have some very committed volunteers. But I agree with Dan that he's just going to be outspent heavily.
There is a question as to how involved Gwen Moore, Representative Gwen Moore, is going to be. She was at the announcement. She is endorsing him. And I'm just interested in knowing how active she is going to be in supporting Chris Larson in this race.
For more on this, you can check out jsonline.com/politics. You can also find that audio on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. And if you're looking for other podcasts to listen to, part two of Gina Barton's Unsolved podcast came out last week.
There were so many issues with the initial investigation into John's death. He was just 14, and he disappeared from Franklin High School, so there were huge amounts of publicity. Officers didn't have the sophisticated training cops have today. The five different agencies working on the case had a whole host of issues with jurisdiction and communication. An FBI profiler told the investigators to look for a gay or bisexual man, but that really limited the scope of the investigation. So in 2001, when Detective Kent Schoonover of the Hales Corners Police Department takes over the case, it's not surprising that it's gone unsolved for 25 years.
We've got part three coming out on Wednesday. Be sure to subscribe to that podcast through iTunes and Stitcher Radio as well. And with that, I'll wrap up today's show. Thanks so much for listening, and be sure to check back next week for more.